You've been taught to work for money. And if you're taught to work for money, you're already doing different things than the wealthy, because the wealthy learned they can only make so much money by working for it. The rest of it has to be their money working for them. We're never taught to make our money work for us. Money's a tool. It's just like the shovel in your driveway.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm super excited to announce our special guest, Chris Noggle. Chris, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Oh, it's my honor and privilege. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So everyone, from pro snowboarder to money mogul, Chris Noggle has dedicated his life to being America's number one money mentor. His success includes managing over $30 million in assets in the financial services and advisory industry and tens of millions in the real estate business. So everyone, welcome Chris Noggle. Chris, why don't you give us a little bit of background as to, you know, where you started? Obviously, you were a major snowboarder. What drew you into the space of wanting to get on top of your money game?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a lower middle class family. Mom raised me. Dad was an alcoholic. So we didn't have any money. So I had to be very resourceful. It was never about the actual resources. And my mom always just taught me to dream. And as a young kid, I just watched a lot of snowboard videos, and we have a lot of snow here in Buffalo, New York. So I wanted to be a pro snowboarder, big, big dream. And everybody said I couldn't do it. So that's where it all started. And on that journey to becoming a pro snowboarder, you got to spend a lot of time on snow. And we didn't have money to buy lift passes and everything else. So I spent a lot of time at a country club by my house, and I would build jumps out of the sand traps in this ravine. And that's how I mastered a lot of the tricks. And then when I got a little bit older, about 14, I started working on a farm, and at 16, got a big boy job. And that big boy job actually degraded me so badly because the owner just put me down every time I was there. And I'll never forget the day I walked in. I was probably clinically depressed, and I quit trading for hours at 16 years old. And I came home and told mom. I
said, was that a desk job, Chris?
Sorry. No, it was at a restaurant. It was an Italian restaurant. And I swear to God, like, either I was a terrible prep cook, or they just weren't good employers that, you know, at treating their employees good. But it was an awful job. And it was enough to make me say, I just have to do it on my own. Started a clothing line in my mom's basement. And that's where I became an entrepreneur. At 16, knew nothing about it. And that clothing line, I took off and started selling it to all these snowboard shops, and got the next big idea to open a skateboard snowboard store. Because if you got the clothing line, why not have the store? And I was 17 at the time. And
just real quick, Chris, I just want to circle back to something that's an important point, which is, why did you decide to become an entrepreneur at that moment?
It wasn't like a technical or long-winded thing. It was just, that was the only thing I thought of to make money in order to pay for my snowboarding, you know, hobby at the point, trying to chase that dream. So I just needed money, and I didn't want to ever be treated that way by an employer. And, you know, at 16, you don't know that other employers can be good. You just know your first experience. And that first experience was one just degrading me and literally brought me to the point where I was depressed. I remember my grades at school, everything went down because I thought I could do nothing right. So that was it. It was just sheerly, I don't want to work for anybody else. So I'm just going to start a clothing line. And I had always admired like some of the skateboard, snowboard clothing lines. I loved how they did things, their marketing. And I'm like, I want to do that. That's how it started. And I was always a good artist. So I would just draw the designs, and a couple of my buddies in high school would just draw artwork, and we sold them through school out of backpacks. And then I started selling them to stores that were putting on snowboard contests. By 17, I had them in a bunch of stores. And that's where the idea came from, to do Fat Man Board Shops instead of Fat Clothing Company. It was all the PHAT, if you remember that, you know, the cool, I think is what it stood for.
Yeah.
You know, raising 70 grand as a 17-year-old who doesn't come from money was proving to be quite difficult. And everybody told me no. My dad told me to get a job at the factory. Nobody supported my dream. And I remember my dream almost died and my mom saw this. She didn't have anything but the 2-bedroom, 700 square foot house that I grew up in. So she put that house on the line so her punk snowboard kid could chase his dream. She collateralized an SBA loan with her house.
Wow.
Now I look back and I'm like, mom, that was so stupid, stupid of you to do. I could have lost all of that. But you know, at 17, it was actually November of 94. I was 18 years old when Fat Man opened and it opened. We got off to a good start, but I remember there was a lot of times where I didn't think I was going to make it to the next day, but I always knew if I failed, I lost the house. And that wasn't even an option. So that's like the early years. And I did become a pro snowboarder. I was living like just an awesome life, riding professionally, running my shops. And that went on all the way up to the early 2000s, right when the dot-com crash hit and the planes hit the towers. I never forget. I just got back from an ASR trade show in California and I'm driving to my newest store in Orchard Park, New York. And I'm listening to the radio and the planes hit the tower. And I'm like, oh my God, was that just a little, you know, little prop plane? And no. And that was the beginning of the recession. And I had never seen a recession. It brought my retail stores down 30%. I had to get a job. So I was either going to deliver pizzas with my friend Mike or get a real job. And the only people that called me, it's funny, you know, I'm a young entrepreneur, punk snowboard kid. And the only people calling me were Wall Street firms. I mean, who wants me in Wall Street? But that's how I ended up in the money space. It was out of sheer necessity.
What do you chalk that up to? Why do you think
it's an easy explanation? So in the financial advisory world, they're looking for a very specific person, somebody that's a self-starter, somebody that doesn't want to work a 9-to-5 punching a clock. They want somebody who's going to go out there and get it. And that's how it works. It's feast or famine in the financial advisory world. It's, you know, you either go out there and earn your keep or you're out of the business. And I watched a lot of advisors in my first year come and go because they couldn't make it. But for me, you got to remember, I'm self-employed. I was used to living on next to nothing. And I was used to these cycles of having money and then having nothing. So I had to make money stretch. So I think that's the reason why I was able to make it in the advisory world. And not only make it, I actually loved it. I thought it was supposed to be a temporary thing. I just wanted to go back to my stores, but I started loving it. I started building clients. And I remember, never forget, I'm in the bullpen and I'm looking around. This is early on. I'm seeing all these big offices around this office and all these big advisors who made huge money, right? Back then it was huge money. And I'm thinking, how do I get to one of those offices? And I'd watch them and they'd get there at 9. They'd go to lunch for 2 hours and they'd leave at 4 to go golf. And I'm like, okay, so if that's how they're doing it and they made it this far, all I need to do is do everything they're unwilling to do. So I got there at 7. I worked through lunch and ate little mulberries from Tupperware. And then I worked till 7-8 at night. And I made all my appointments in the evening when people got home from work. And then I would spend the afternoons going out on appointments. And I became one of the top 3 advisors for that firm in a very short period of time. So I was making my first year, 74 grand. The next year I made over 100 and it just went up from there. So remember, I'm an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I think the most I ever made in my store, actually, I remember I paid myself a salary, and everybody's going to laugh at this, of $200 a week, Fat Man. To me, that was a lot of money. I remember putting the pro formas together for Fat Man and the net profit was $30,000. I remember thinking, I can't believe I'm going to make $30,000. Think about that, right? Like I'm a 17-year-old kid doing pro formas and I'm thinking, I'm going to make $30,000. Now this is 94, so that was more money than it is today, but it was such a monumental, God, I'm getting fired up just thinking about it, how exciting that was. And then my first year as an advisor, I make 74. So I like more than doubled that. So I knew I was doing something right. And I got into real estate in 06. So I'm doing the advisory thing. I'm still snowboarding professionally, still have my retail stores. And I watched a TV show where they were flipping houses. And I said, I can do that. So me and my best friend, Mike, the pizza delivery guy, bought a house and we started renovating it. It only took us a year to finish it. And we only made 8 grand instead of the 40 we were supposed to, but at least I got the taste of it. And then the next year I did another one. And then in 2008, I was crushing. I was definitely at the peak of my financial advisory career. I was at the peak of my snowboarding career. And I bought this dilapidated paint store 2 buildings down from my main Fat Man store. And I was going to develop it into a strip mall. Borrowed the money from a hard money lender. And then all of a sudden, you know exactly what's coming, right? Mm-hmm. 2008. There's a right time to do things and a wrong time.
Oh my God.
And the Great Recession, I swear to God, it hit me like a Mack truck out of left field. I felt like I was sitting here saying, hey, man, and a truck hits me from the side. it brought me to my knees to the point where I had one payment left in, I exhausted everything. All my 401ks were loaned out. My life insurance policies were loaned out. I had no money left. I had just moved my girlfriend into my house. She was like, you know, the token girlfriend at the time. And I remember coming home one night and saying to Larissa, I said, sweetie, I need your help. I couldn't make it. I said, I need your help paying the mortgage. I need your help paying the utilities. And by the way, Larissa, we have to move Pete into that bedroom down the hall, and my friend Jessica is going to move into the upstairs. I mean, listen, when your back's up against the wall, you know, you can either just lay down and say, I quit, or you can say, I'm going to do whatever it takes. And I just wasn't willing to quit. So we made it through that period of time barely. And then from 2009 to 14, Warren Buffett was always my hero. I read all of his books, and he was kind of who I based a lot of things I did. And he always said, buy low, sell high, and don't lose money. Well, in 2008, if you remember, real estate tanked. And in 2009, I started buying real estate, pennies on the dollar, apartment buildings, dilapidated ones. But, and I would take the money I was making in the Wall Street job, I would put it into the buildings. I would take the rents that I had coming in, I would plow it back into renovating units. And I would spend my weekends putting drywall up, painting. And those are exciting times. But looking back, like, that sucked.
Yeah, totally.
But I got up to 36 units, and I was doing it, you know, the way I was taught to do it, but it was completely wrong. And by the 37th unit, the bank froze, basically said no. They said they wouldn't finance it. My debt to income ratio was way out of whack, said the bank, and they froze my lines of credit. Now, I was highly leveraged at this point. You got to remember, there's a lot of things that happened in there that I left out, but I was highly leveraged trying to get as many of these units as I could while they were still cheap. And when they pulled that line of credit, it wasn't just them freezing a line. It was literally like cutting my hands off. I no longer could afford to keep operations going. So I had to then start selling properties, and I'd sell one and then another. And eventually I had to sell them all. I sold every one of those units. And then I had to sell the dream house that me and Larissa lived in. We had bought our dream house, and I had to sell it, 171 Radcliffe. So you can see here.
Wait, real quick, Chris, I just want to circle back on something important, which is you said you were doing it all wrong. Like, what was wrong about how you were purchasing those properties?
Yeah, I'd never been taught how to use commercial mortgages. I'd never been taught really about private money. I knew nothing about this. I'm a high-level financial advisor, but I knew nothing about how real estate investors, high-end ones, were actually doing what they were doing. And I was just using a traditional bank. I was buying them in my personal name, some of them in an LLC, but it was always a personal mortgage. Because, you know, like most people, like when they look at a personal mortgage versus a commercial, they're like, okay, this one's 3%, this one's 5%. Which one are you going to go with? Oh, I want the lower interest rate. But that's a complete trap, because the way that they calculate the debt to income ratio, nobody's ever going to get over 10 properties. It's not going to happen. Mathematically, it's not. And I didn't know that. Nobody showed me that. So I was close to that 10 properties, and that was it. Game over. And, you know, it wasn't that I couldn't have recuperated. It was just, I was so highly leveraged that when they froze that line, like, there was just nothing else. I never recuperated from 2009. Sure, I was making decent money, but
And they froze your line of credit because they realized or discovered that you were too highly leveraged.
Yeah, I was a high risk. So they said, in my debt to income ratio, for the income I was bringing in with the rents, you know, I think they only calculated, if I recall, 70% of my gross rents that were coming in. I'm like, why wouldn't you use 100%? That's not how we do it. And then my income from my financial advisory practice, I had, you know, lots of write-offs that I took against that. So when they looked at that and my income, it just didn't support what I was doing by bank rules. And here's what I didn't know. And a lot of people should take a lesson from this, because banks are in control of your money if you are not in control. Well, I wasn't in control. And the banks, not only that, they're always looking to make mergers, do things. This bank was a community bank, and they were actually selling to a large traditional conglomerate of banks. So I think I was just out of the risk profile for them to sell this bank. So they just had to get rid of the risk, which was me. And yeah, it was looking back, it's painful to think about it. I mean, think of that, 2009 to 14. Imagine what properties sold for then and what they'd be worth today. I try not to think about it, but it would have been significant.
So yeah, totally. I mean, you know, we can't change the past, but we can focus on the future. But so just really quick, like for the listeners who aren't so familiar, what would you recommend instead of, you know, doing the personal or buying houses in your personal name with the lower interest rate?
Yeah, so it's easy. I mean, the biggest thing I would suggest, if you were doing what I was doing, which I was buying apartment buildings and I was coming up with 20% out of pocket plus the rehab. So if you wanted to go that route, get familiar with local community banks, right? Find the local community banks in your town that lend on real estate and like that risk. Then find out ones that actually will give you a commercial mortgage. Now, commercial means in your entity's name. So you're buying the property with your entity, your LLC, your S Corp, your C Corp. Your personal name doesn't exist so in the deal except for a personal guarantor. So they're going to look at you personally, but they're really going to look at the viability of the company and the project. And in commercial lending, like the rules are totally different. Number one, you know, this doesn't really exist today, but back then I was able to borrow up to 90% of the deal commercially, and, you know, actually up to 100% if you really did it right, but I was only doing 80. So the commercial mortgage doesn't show up in your personal credit report, doesn't count just your debt to income ratio personally. And it also protects you because you're now buying the property with your entity. So if somebody slips and falls, luckily it never happened to me. Actually it did, but we won't go there. You're not hanging out to dry with liability. So that's the biggest thing I'd suggest is look at commercial lenders in your local town that are community, just go to community banks. They're the only ones that really give two craps about you and your business. Secondarily, what I didn't know about was I knew about hard money lenders, but they were so stinking expensive. So I was always chasing the lowest interest rate. But chasing the lowest interest rate sent me down the wrong path. I should have just been looking at what the best money was for that particular deal. A lot of those deals, the best thing I should have been doing is finding private money from people that I knew in my primary circles and just paying them whatever interest rate they wanted, 10, 12%, having them give me the money for the deal, renovate the deal with someone else's money, then take the deal to the bank and refinance it. It would have been a much better path to success. But again, who tells you that? Nobody. I mean, I think the only thing I'd read about real estate then was rich dad, poor dad, you know, assets versus liabilities. Got it. Check. Yeah. Gone. And, you know, I think that's the biggest thing I missed.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Thanks for explaining that. I think it's important. Okay. So you exited real estate and then tell us what's next.
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-cap.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Yeah. So, you know, at that point, that was the lowest point of my life. Just lost everything. You know, everything was suffering, my relationship. And I remember I got a postcard in the mail saying, come to this 3-day seminar to learn how to flip houses. So you can imagine, I get this postcard, almost goes in the garbage, and I look on the back and it says, oh, and if you show up, you get a free iPod shuffle. I had nothing to lose, but I had an iPod shuffle to gain. So off I went. And at this event, I was so bored. I remember I even wore a suit because financial, I was an advisor. I just had this ego and this image thing. It was so stupid. But I'm there and there's two speakers that go up, Mike and Greg, never forget it. And they start talking about money. Mike had an A&E TV show, Flipping Houses. Greg was the bank. And as soon as they started talking about money, my ears perk up. I sit up in the chair. I'm like, oh, money. Okay, this is my topic. And they start telling me what they're doing, how they're doing it, what money they're using. And everything they said was completely foreign, which to me, remember, I'm at this point 13 or 14 years as a high-level advisor. And these guys are talking about things I've never heard of at all. Privatized banking. They're talking about being the bank. They're talking about self-directed IRAs, which I'd only heard glimmers of in the world. And I wasn't even allowed to talk about them in the financial advisory world because I couldn't get paid. That's funny, right? How in the financial advisory world, you can't talk about things if they don't make money for your brokerage, but we won't go down that rabbit hole. So I was instantly just thinking to myself, if this is just an hour of these guys talking, what else don't I know? What do I think I know that just ain't so? And I dove in and I started following the wealthy around, starting with these two, but then I got into their circles and met all their friends, which were, you know, multimillionaires and some billionaires. And I started being an advisor. I was pretty good at talking about money. I started asking them, what do you do with money? Where does your money go? When you make money on a deal, where's this money going? And what I found is that every one of these extremely successful guys were doing the opposite of everything I was ever taught to do as an advisor. And instantly, I started questioning it all. And I started diving in and learning what the wealthy know what they do and how, why is it different? And why is it that me and everybody else, you know, and I just want to say the non-wealthy, you know, or whatever stage they're at, middle class, low class, why is it we're not privy to this information? And I started thinking, okay, is it their advisors? No, not at all. And it was very simple. It came down to the wealthy did one thing different with their money that we were never taught, because we weren't taught that by the banks, by the advisors, by the brokerages, because the brokerages, banks, and advisors can't get paid to do what the wealthy do. The wealthy had advisors, but they were on retainer. So they were getting advice that was, you know, perfect for them, fiduciary, you know, whatever you want to call it. So they were doing things that nobody else would be told of, because nobody could make money by telling them to do them. And that was it. And I put it all together, and like, I have literally made an entire career around giving my best stuff away for free, telling people what I learned and the secrets of the wealthy so that they can get back control of their money. Because that's the biggest thing. We all are taught our whole lives to make money, to trade it, work for money, make it, and then give up control of it. Put it in a 401k, put it in the bank, give it away to somebody else. You're not a good steward of your money. And that's backwards, backwards.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I just love everything you're saying because, well, you know, so many people, and I mean, nothing against individual financial advisors. Like, I know many and they're wonderful people and, you know, they're smart at what they do, but what they do isn't going to make you wealthy. Right. And so, I mean, I would love to hear just some of the learnings. Like, what is it that you currently think are some of the most important lessons to teach people? I mean, obviously limited time, but let's hear it.
Very simple. And I'm going to try to keep this super high level. And a lot of people, there's way more to unpack here, so that they'll have to watch some videos on my YouTube. But
yeah,
here's the biggest problems. Let's start right from the beginning. You've been taught to work for money. And if you're taught to work for money, you're already doing different things than the wealthy, because the wealthy learned they can only make so much money by working for it. The rest of it has to be their money working for them. We're never taught to make our money work for us. Money's a tool. Just like the shovel in your driveway. So what do the wealthy do different? Like, how do they make their money work? Well, first off, they don't put their money the same place we do. They don't put their money in the bank. They keep very little money in most cases in a traditional bank outside of working capital. Their money goes the same place the Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, the Walt Disneys, the Ray Crocs, and so many others put their money. And that is into privatized banking policies. So what is that? And this is the part where everybody, because I don't have a lot of time to get into this, but everybody like thinks they know what they don't know. And I was one of them. What is a privatized bank? A privatized bank isn't a bank at all. It's a giant mutually owned insurance company. And how do you deposit your money in a giant mutually owned insurance company? It's through a vehicle that's been around for hundreds of years called a whole life insurance policy. Now, before anyone thinks they know what they don't know about a whole life, all whole lives are not built the same. This is not a whole life that you buy from your insurance agent, your brother-in-law, or the insurance store. This is completely engineered and designed to do something very different than the whole life that you think you know about does. So because it's built backwards and built to work as a banking system, here's the one thing it does. This is what the wealthy understand. So this is important. If they change one thing, which is where, and I'm holding a $100 bill for any of you listening. If they change where that $100 bill goes first, the first thing is insurance companies guarantee much higher interest rates. Bank might pay a 1% if you're lucky right now. Insurance companies as of 2021 are paying 4% contractually guaranteed. Plus every year they're paying a dividend. So you can get up to 6% on your money in this specially designed and engineered whole life versus making 1% or less in the bank. And remember, we're only talking about guaranteed accounts. Secondarily, let's say I put 100 in that account. And let's just say I take 100 back out of that account. You couldn't do this in the first couple of years, but I put 100 in, it's making the equivalent of 6% with dividend. And then I take 100 out. If that was your bank, how much money's left in your bank account? Zero, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you put 100 in, you took 100 out. So you're making interest on nothing if you took the money out. In an insurance company, when you put money in, you can take it out as a loan, but the loan never needs to be paid back because the loan is just leveraging your death benefit that's paid out when you die. So the insurance company gives you a loan against your death benefit. They do charge you interest, but it's not as much as what you're earning. So now I've got this $100 in my hand that is a loan against my death benefit. So I just leverage the death benefit. The second thing that the wealthy understand is they don't like paying taxes. So loans, even if I took all the gains out of this policy, that's not taxable. So I get to use tax-free money that is now, you know, that came from my policy. But the most important thing is this, and this is the part that you need to watch the video to understand. That $100 that was in my account, even though I'm holding the $100 in my hand, I'm not holding my money. This is the insurance company's money. My 100 grand or my $100 is still in the policy, earning interest and dividends uninterrupted. So if you understand Albert Einstein's theory of compound interest, he said, those that understand it, earn it. Those that don't, pay it. I'm earning it all the time. And the wealthy are earning it all the time, even though they're using it. Mm-hmm. So now I've got control of my money to go out and buy real estate, invest in syndications, put it in notes, whatever flavor you have and where you invest your money, you have the ability to now make money twice instead of once without working harder, longer, or taking on any risk. That's the first thing the wealthy do. The second thing they do is they apply banking strategies in everything. They treat their money the same as they would treat the bank's money. In other words, if they're going to buy a car and they have cash to pay for the car, they take the cash from their private banking policy. They pay cash for the car. So now they own the car free and clear, but they don't stop there. They understand that if they bought this with a bank loan, they'd have to make a monthly payment to a bank. So they say, okay, well, the bank would have charged me $500 for this car every month. I'm going to take $500 and I'm going to take this $500 and I'm going to move that money back into my private bank because I'm treating my money the same as I treat the bank's money. And the wealthy never, very few of them. If you find one that does put a ton of money in a qualified retirement plan, please let me know who it is and why they're doing it. They don't do that. They have other ways to get tax deductions called businesses or syndications through depreciation and all sorts of things. They understand that. They don't put their money in 401ks like we're taught to do because that's giving up control of their money. And they don't want their money sitting in something for 5, 10, 15 years that they can't touch without paying taxes and penalties because when an opportunity comes across their desk, they want to take action on that opportunity, which means they need to be in control of their money at all times to take advantage of that. That's why the wealthy always seem to get, oh, they're so lucky they get all the opportunities. No, they don't. They're just in control of their money. So the opportunities that come to them, they can act on it. Where, you know, me prior to knowing this stuff, I put a ton of money in 401ks. And when an opportunity came, I'm like, oh boy, I wish I could do this opportunity. Oh, that syndication deal is so awesome. I wish I could do this, but my money's in the 401k. Oh, my money's in stocks and they're down. If it was last week, my stocks were up. I could have taken the money out and made, but now I can't. Sorry, I can't do this syndication deal. You see what I'm saying? It's like, it's so simple. It's changing one thing. It's putting yourself in control of your money so that that money is now able to work for you much harder in opportunities that actually make sense. And quite simply, I mean, I think a lot of people just need to start learning to say no so that they can say yes to the right thing when it comes up. Sorry, it was a lot to unpack and there's way more to that than what I got into there.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, you have clearly have a ton of content, which would be super valuable to go into. And, you know, just to reiterate, one of the important points that you made is like having control of your money and not believing that you're not the best steward of your money. I mean, yes, it does take some work and education to learn how to invest your money. And that, you know, that's an investment of time and energy that you can make, but just giving up control of your money to, you know, whether it's your financial advisor, your 401k, which you have pretty much no control over, that's only going to get you so far, right? And probably not where you want to be. So I think that's a really important point. I want to just circle back on something you said about buying the car and treating yourself like the bank. Can you just break that down? What exactly you meant? Like, did you say just, do you mean just they put $500 away so that they can invest it later?
Yeah, I went really fast through that. So let's just talk about a car. So I'll give it to your entire audience for free. They can get a booklet that I did teaching them how to get all the money back for every single car they will ever buy, drive, and own. There's no catch to it. There's no gray area. It's this simple. There's three ways you can buy a car, right? You can pay cash for a car. What's another way you can buy a car?
You can get an auto loan.
Yeah, you can finance the car through a bank or a finance company. What's the third way you can buy a car?
You can
lease it.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah, lease
it. You could trade monthly payments for the right to borrow and rent the car. And the fourth way is you can steal the car, but don't do that. So if there's four ways to buy a car, which is the most efficient? Well, a lot of people argue things. CPAs have heydays over this, but really a lot of people would say, well, the best way to buy the car is to be the bank. So let's say you were going to pay cash for a car. Most people take cash out of someplace, a stock account, a savings account, and they go to the dealership, they buy their vehicle, they get the keys. And what did they just do? Number one, they got a depreciating vehicle that they're super excited about. But number two, they gave up the interest earning potential on that money.
Yeah.
All that money you paid for the car is now gone in somebody else's control and you can't earn anything on that money. It's gone forever.
Right.
So what if we could change the dynamic? You can't. Simple. So now you paid cash for the car because you saved up for it. That's the downside. A lot of people want instant gratification. This method, you have to actually save for the car. You paid for the car, but now take one additional step. When you're at the dealership, and I know a lot of men and women love negotiating for cars. So when you're at the dealership, negotiate the monthly price before you say you're going to pay cash for it. And the dealership goes back and forth with the credit manager. All right, no, that's too much. 620. Nope, I need to be at 600. They come back and they got 600. Great. How did you do that? It's a 6-year note. 3% interest. Perfect. So now what you've got is you've got the finance company just figured out your monthly payment. So let's just say it's $600. So you have the car, and then right before they're ready to draw up the loan paperwork, you're like, hold on a second, I don't need the loan. Well, why did we just do that? Because I needed you to tell me how much to pay my bank. So now I got a $600 monthly payment that I would have exchanged to them for this vehicle every month. So what I'm doing now is I pay cash for the car. I own the car, but now I need to get all the money back for that car. So take the $600 you would have paid for that car. Now, set up a bill pay and have that $600 paid back to your private bank. So every month, $600 goes back into your private bank. Now, remember, what you're doing here is you're paying yourself first, rule number one. Rule number two, you're paying yourself with interest because you got to treat your money the same way you treat the bank's money. The bank was going to charge you 3%, so you charge yourself 3%. And number three, you got to recycle and recapture all the money you normally would give away to everybody else. And you got to be the bank. So you take the $600 a month and you put it back into your bank. And at the end of the 5 or 6 year term, whatever the note is, all the money for that car and then some is back in your account. Plus you got a bought and paid for vehicle in the driveway, which has value. You effectively just got all the money back for every vehicle without having to sell the vehicle. Mm-hmm. Sell the vehicle and that's a profit.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Really important concepts there about being the bank and, you know, treating your money with like the respect that, you know, you should treat it with. So
absolutely. Well yeah. said.
Awesome. Okay. Well,
can I hit one more thing on syndication? Because I know you talk about syndication a lot. And I think it's really important to understand that a lot of people out there, they all know real estate is a good investment. I got into real estate because all my wealthiest clients were in real estate. And I'm like, well, if they're in it, I should be in it. But a lot of people stop there because they don't have the resources. They think, oh, I wish I could buy that apartment building. I wish I could buy that 100 unit building like Grant Cardone or whoever else, but I can't because I don't have that much money. That's short-sighted thinking. Syndications allow the average person, or I should say not the average, average accredited investor, if I want to be, you know, correct about this, they have the ability to buy a fractional portion of a deal, you know, a very limited amount of money, 50 grand, 100 grand, whatever it is. And then they can get the benefits that the wealthy get for buying the entire thing. But what most people don't understand is the wealthy typically do exactly what we're talking about. They don't often buy and take down the entire project themselves. They have investors that come in under them. So they do it as a group because again, like getting back to the wealthy, they understand leverage and velocity and they want the velocity on their side. So syndications give the average person the ability to really benefit from giant portfolios of rentals, passive income, tax deductions, and they can do it within the confines of whatever their ability to fund a deal are. It doesn't have to be $10 million. It might be 100 grand or 50 grand. I just think that a lot of people miss out on opportunities because they think they need to have all the money and they're completely wrong.
Totally. Yeah, it's such a good point. And you know, if you invest in a syndication with 25 or 50K, then you know, you may have been saving up for trying to buy a rental property or something like that. And depending on where you're buying, that's not enough, right? So you can get into a deal and then you start to learn by just being part of a deal, right? And so you start to see what kind of information, what's happening with the property, et cetera. And so, yeah, it's a really great way for people to get exposure and to be in control of their, you know, in control of their money, but without the responsibilities. So
perfect. I love the way you said that. Yeah. I mean, a lot of people like they got 25 grand. They're like, oh, I can't buy that duplex. It's out of my price range. You can still get in real estate.
Yeah.
Just get resourceful. Stop thinking it's about your actual resources and start being resourceful.
Yeah, totally. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for sharing like your story and so much about, you know, the money mindset and how to actually, I mean, coming from someone who was a financial advisor for 14 years and then just realizing that everything that you knew about money was kind of not exactly really, I mean, was not how you want to be thinking about it going forward. I mean, I think that's a pretty incredible story because so many people, you know, they're like, well, what does my financial advisor think about this? And
we don't have time for me to answer that one. 16 years as an advisor, I can almost tell you exactly what your advisor would say, no matter what you ask them. And it's usually not in your best interest. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with advisors. Some of them are very good. Some of them are very bad, but you got to remember if you follow the dollar, they are taught to do things that make them money and it might not be in your best interest in every single case.
Yeah, for sure. Totally. Awesome. Well, okay, Chris, how can the listeners learn more about you and your content and anything else you'd love to share? I know you shared your book. Please give us the goods.
Yeah. So I want to give that book to everybody for free. The book that shows you how to get all the money back for every car you buy, drive and own. So you're just going to go to chrisnoggle.com and there's a wealth webinar we do every Wednesday at 1 o'clock. It's completely free. Register for it and we'll send you the book. And also while you're there, if you like the car thing and you like, you know, the idea of being your private bank, watch a 90-minute video. It's right in the free resources. Everything on my website is free. So you should take advantage of it.
Awesome. All right, Chris. Well, thank you so much for your sharing your wealth of knowledge and experience and your long history. And yeah, Have a great day. We'll see you next time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.